From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Stephanie Lecce. Today on the program, our Real Talk segment explains how child support is putting some dads in debt. Later, how nurse-managed clinics are changing the healthcare scene in Milwaukee.
Nurse practitioner-led clinics are very successful across the country and actually has very high customer satisfaction because there's something special about the relationship between a nurse and a patient.
Plus, Milwaukee chef and author Alamelu Vivaron gets requests for specialized Indian recipes.
They said, Alamelu, the vegetable, rice dish, and the lean proteins will lend itself to gluten-free diet. So I decided that's what I want to do. I want to help all these people.
And a new guide to Milwaukee points out the city's hidden gems. Lake Effect comes your way next after news from NPR and Milwaukee Public Radio. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Stephanie Lecce. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Our recent Real Talk segments have been exploring the financial challenges many of Milwaukee's black men face. Contributor and UWM professor of social welfare David Pate says these men carry a disproportionate amount of debt. But there's one contributing factor to that debt that's fairly surprising: child support. Pate says it's a necessary but complex system, so today we begin a two-part conversation on the intersection between debt and child support. To add some insight, Pate's brought on board Dr. Gabriela Sandoval, Director of Policy and Research at the Insight Center for Community Economic Development, based in California. She's worked on a national project tracking the needs of low-income fathers with Nino Rodriguez, who is the program and policy specialist at the Center for Family Policy and Practice, which is based in Madison. They join me in the studio and on the phone now. David, Gabriela, Nino, welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we've been talking about the wealth gap, focusing in on the debt carried by black men in our communities. And one of the factors that David and Ann Price have identified as contributing to that debt load is child support. So I want to start by having you explain, what kind of debt is child support? Why is this such a significant issue?
Well, child support is significant in very poor communities in particular because women tend to need some support, some economic security, and they use, like, for example, in Wisconsin, a W-2 system. The W-2 system, which has been often referred to as welfare, requires that the mother name a father. She has to name someone who's going to also be involved in paying what we call child support or being contributing to the child support program. For the one thing about the child support program and the its relationship to welfare is that the money that he pays in child support goes to reimburse the state in most states in the country. In Wisconsin, we do have what is called a pass-through where a certain amount of that money or a portion of that money is given back to the mother. But the state owns that child support, and they can decide whether to keep it or to give it to her. Now, because we have such a high rate of unmarried families amongst African Americans, at this point 75% of black families are unmarried, you have a lot of also high poverty in black families. So therefore, this relationship is where this child support issue comes in. And once those orders start becoming official, you also are looking at what's the unemployment rate of black men. So when they don't have a job and they have this child support debt that's clicking every day, it accumulates and it gets to be a significant debt for them. And it also has interest attached to it.
Well, let me ask you, Gabriela, do the courts just not take into consideration the amount that a father is making or can make when they're determining how much he must pay?
So that definitely varies by state. But in fact, oftentimes what we find is a process of imputation where a judge will say, this man looks like he could pay X amount. And so whether or not he actually can or, you know, has access to a job that will allow him to both support himself economically as well as make payments monthly on this for this debt or for child support becomes irrelevant.
Yeah, I do have something to share about that. I mean, one of the issues with how child support works in terms of determining how much a parent can afford to pay in Wisconsin, and we'll use the example of if you're paying child support for two children, the standard order is that you're paying 25% of your gross income. So whatever you're making before taxes, we take 25% of that. And the debate about, well, how do you handle the situation of parents with very low incomes, in one sense really is about, you know, how poor are we going to, or how poor are we willing to, in terms of public policy, make these people. Parents do get a break when their income falls below a certain level, but we're talking about very low levels of income. I mean, you would have to be making below about $13,000 a year before you start getting a break on the 25% of your income. So it really, the policy discussion related to, you know, are we setting these orders appropriately? When you're looking at low-income parents, it's more about, you know, how far are we going to push them into poverty? How far is their income going to be reduced? And it's pretty far, in my opinion.
Let me ask then, do we know how much someone needs to make in order to not fall further into poverty but be able to pay the child support that's required?
So for Milwaukee, I'm going to call this the $36,000 man. I'm kind of riffing on, you know, the old TV show, The Million Dollar Man. There's an organization based out of D.C. called Wider Opportunities for Women. We really like the work that they do. They've come up with basically a monthly budget. Like, what would you need to be earning in order to cover all your basics, to be able to set aside some emergency money to cover a spell of unemployment if you're unemployed, to put away some money for retirement? And they developed this information for many states and many counties and many cities all around the country, including, fortunately for our discussion, Milwaukee. So what does this good job, good income look like for Milwaukee? A few assumptions, first of all, that they make. When we say good job, we're talking working full time. We're talking you have access to health insurance benefits through your employer. Your employer offers an ability for you to participate in some kind of retirement plan like a 401k. So when we're thinking good job, it's a good job with benefits. So for a single person, no kids, what that figure looks like is about $27,000 a year in Milwaukee, the equivalent of earning about $13 an hour. So not quite double minimum wage, but in that general ballpark. Now, we'll talk for a second about the sort of stereotypical single parent with two kids that we always hear about. You know, when you think of like the poor person struggling to make ends meet, for a lot of people, that's what comes to mind. So using this organization's figures in Milwaukee, what we come up with is that a single parent with two school-age kids would need to be earning about $46,000 a year to have economic security. And that's about $22 an hour working full-time.
And I believe that's actually higher than the median income level in Wisconsin.
Right. If I can interrupt a little bit, the median income level in Milwaukee is $33,000. The median for our county is $50,000 because you include all the Waukesha, Brookfield, and all the other cities.
So clearly the budgets that they put together, and I hear this question a lot when I talk about this in other contexts. One question I get from people is, those numbers just seem unrealistically high. Like, how could it possibly be that high? But the method that they used to come up with these numbers, I think, is pretty solid. You know, they're looking at, what's fair market rent for an appropriate size apartment for the number of people in your family? What is an average transportation cost? What is the average cost of health care in the city you're living in? These aren't fantasy numbers. So now to bring it back to the $36,000 man, in the context of the guy who's paying child support for two kids, the $36,000 is the figure that we come up with. In other words, how much would he need to be able to take care of himself as a single person? And then on top of that, be paying the 25% of his income that he's going to owe for his kids, for child support. So it's basically $36,000, about $17 an hour. So slightly more than double the minimum wage.
Gabriella, is this the kind of situation you're seeing in the project that you're working with Nino on, looking at it from the national perspective, where someone needs to be making a certain amount, and in most cases in a community, they're just not?
Yes. In fact, that is what we're seeing. The other thing that we see, however, is that oftentimes men may have the means to pay at first, but after a few years may come across a bout of unemployment. And then again, as David mentioned, that debt continues to climb. And they can't necessarily go back and get a revision on what their child support order is. So it's both a lack of quality jobs that ensure the economic security of the man and his ability to pay the child support order, but also the kind of stability of those jobs over the long term, because the fact is most of us will face at least one bout of unemployment throughout our lifetime.
Right. And just to expand on that, I think, David, you had told me this earlier, that in that same vein that you can't necessarily adjust, make an adjustment to what you're required to pay. It's this idea that, well, you were able to get a job that paid this much, so you should be able to get another one that pays that much. Therefore, you're going to continue paying this much.
You can't adjust this. This is one of those debts where you can't erase it in bankruptcy. It stays with you for life. The only people that can forgive this debt is the mother who is the recipient of this order, or the state in this instance. And again, for people in New Orleans, I don't want to confuse them that this particular one is tied to someone who has received a welfare benefit that we're talking about, not someone who is middle class and has lawyers on both sides. But I do think it's important to say that we're talking about primarily people who have had some relationship with the state, not always. But this debt is one you can't just say, I want to go to bankruptcy court and get rid of it, because the 1996 laws that President Clinton put into place around ending welfare as we know it made it much more difficult to do that. For good reason, because women do need to have money to take care of their children. Some middle-class families were taking advantage of that, and wealthy families were taking advantage of the fact you could go in and adjust it in bankruptcy court. But the one thing you do have is, and I do want to say, there is one thing you can do is do a modification, but that requires a knowledge of the law. And we're going to have a conversation down the road about what's the legal side of this in the future around being poor and using law to change this. But there is a way you can do a modification.
There seems to be this perception that dads who don't pay child support, who skip out on it, are deadbeats. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if what you're hearing from dads here in our community, if that isn't actually the case, that they want to pay it, it's just an inability to pay it.
I really do think it's inability to pay. I mean, I think over and over in the focus groups that we've conducted with fathers around the country in several cities, including in Milwaukee, in Beloit here in Wisconsin, that's a constant recurring theme. You know, I want to pay. I want to be involved in my kid's life. You know, but where's the jobs? I'll share, if I can, one quote from a father. This is from a group we did in Freeport, Illinois. So not here in Wisconsin, but pretty close to Wisconsin. You know, he said, "We need more jobs. Don't need that much education. Everybody make a nice little amount. You know, you feed your family, you pay your child support. We need more jobs like that around here. And the economy would grow, people would be making money, they'll be spending, but now there's nothing." And I think that's really just a recurring story that you hear from people, that getting back to the question of unemployment and particularly the experience of Black people, Black families, when they're looking for work, the chances are they're less likely to get hired for a variety of reasons. And people just aren't able to find jobs. And in a lot of places, like this father I just quoted from Freeport, the community just doesn't have the jobs in the first place. Like, they would have to go somewhere else or commute really long distances or just move. So that's a theme that we hear over and over. I want to be able to take care of my kids. I want to be able to pay. I want to be involved. I'm just not able to.
And I would think, too, based on what you were saying, that they want to pay. I have not met one man in all of my 15 years of doing this research who has not said, I want to take care of my child. Mm-hmm. It's just that this particular debt, this makes it a lot harder for them. And also because of the fact that this particular debt has certain sanctions or enforcement tactics that go along with it, from having your license taken to being incarcerated. And I think Gabriella, who can maybe even chime in on this, talked about it, as someone who is new to doing this work, was surprised at some of the various things that were going on around people's ability to pay this debt, but also the things that could happen to them in their life that made a big difference. Don't you agree, Gabriella? I remember talking to you about that before.
I totally agree. There's a stark difference, too, that we also have to keep in mind between someone writing a check or, paying out 25% of their income to support their child or to pay back the government right, to reimburse the government. And, you know, there's a difference between that and a father parenting his child, right? A father caring for his child, going to back to school nights, being there, right, to drop off and pick up, to wipe tears away. And that is often not taken into account. And it really is one of the things that stands out from the research that we've done, that these men care deeply about their children. And the phenomenon's been described as, you know, trying to draw blood from a stone. And in fact, yes, it's hard to get money from people who have none. But these men have a wealth of love and affection for their children, which is often completely erased from the narrative.
Real Talk contributor David Pate is an associate professor at the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UWM, and he's founder of the Center for Family Policy and Practice. Nino Rodriguez is the program and policy specialist there. Dr. Gabriela Sandoval is director of policy and research at the Insight Center for Community Economic Development in California. All three will join us tomorrow as we continue our Real Talk look at child support and debt. A quick break now, and in just a moment, how nurse-managed clinics can help bring healthcare to some of Milwaukee's neediest communities. That's next when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Stephanie Lecce. A new primary health clinic is opening today at Milwaukee's Northside YMCA. It's a much-needed addition to the neighborhood's sparse healthcare landscape, but what really makes this clinic unique is it will be run by nurses. The clinic is the result of a partnership between Children's Hospital of Wisconsin and Marquette University College of Nursing. Another of the collaboration's nurse-managed clinics opened last week at the COA Golden Center on the city's north side. Children's Hospital's CEO Peggy Troy and the college's dean Margaret Callahan join me in the studio to talk more about the clinics and improving community health in Milwaukee. Peggy and Margaret, welcome back to Lake Effect.
We're so glad to be here today.
Absolutely.
Why did you decide on these two particular locations?
Really, the way this whole process started was really the good work that Children's Hospital of Wisconsin had done, getting a good sense in our community, what were the neighborhoods of greatest need. And so they spent quite a bit of time talking to the communities, finding out what the community wanted. And we were fortunate in Marquette Nursing that Children's then came to us and asked us to partner with them. So our first clinic opened at the COA Golden Center, and already we have patients that are being seen. We've had our nurse practitioners just be so excited to be part of the community, to be present there. And I think it's a wonderful relationship in a community that really needs primary care providers.
And Peggy, where is the other clinic soon to be opened?
So on October 14th, we're going to open a clinic at the Northside YMCA, similar primary care model. And it's in a community that really does have poor access to health care and has great needs. The other thing we did that was really important as we looked is, first of all, we looked at where the greatest health disparities are, because we really believe that we've got to make an investment in the population health of our community, the health of the population. So we looked at where we had the worst health disparities, because our board of trustees had said, we want the children of Wisconsin to be the healthiest in the nation. And we stack up to about the 50th percentile if you look across the state. But when you get to the central city of Milwaukee, we drop to the fourth worst in the country in outcomes and health for kids. So we looked by zip code where those neighborhoods with the greatest opportunity were located. But we knew we couldn't just put a clinic in a community. I mean, that's one of the, I think, things that healthcare providers often think they know more and better than the community they serve. And so we actually went out and worked with the citizens of that community and said, what do you need? What do you want? How can we be helpful? The other thing we said is we have to have great partners. And so that's why the COA and Northside YMCA, instead of a freestanding clinic, became clear. And the thing that was so wonderful about this partnership with Marquette is that the neighbors in the Golan Heights area said, Imani Heights, said, but we have to have care for the caregivers. And that threw us for a little bit of a lurch in the beginning because we do pediatric care.
I was going to say that seems kind of like an interesting order for children's hospital to be caring for adult caregivers.
Well, because the caregiver said to us, if we're not healthy ourselves, how can we give, you know, the great guidance and care to our kids? And then along came Margaret.
I say this really with all sincerity. The window opened for me. You know, it was the opportunity to do something different, to do something meaningful, provide an opportunity not only for our nurse practitioners who really love to provide this type of care, but for our students. Because what we know is that if students don't see practice like this in a community, they'll never want to work there. And in the future, what we also know is a large part of healthcare will be delivered outside of hospitals. We need to work with a broader perspective just from, you know, preventing colds and flus. We need to start talking and working in communities about things like poverty and access to jobs and all of those kinds of things. And I am so excited not only for the care we'll provide in the clinic, but for our students who will be able to work with the staffs of both of these centers, identifying the kinds of things they want, health fairs, all sorts of kinds of wellness activities. So we see this as the first step into a much deeper relationship in both of these communities.
Well, so let me ask, it may seem self-explanatory, the idea of a nurse-managed clinic, but what work is actually going to be able to be done in these two locations by being managed by nurses from Marquette with the partners that Children's is working with?
Well, I'm going to start out, and then I'm going to let Margaret talk for a minute. But this is one of our projects of innovation, and we know that nurse practitioner-led clinics are very successful across the country and actually has very high customer satisfaction because Margaret and I are both nurses, so we can say there's something special about the relationship between a nurse and a patient. And so these clinics are comprehensive. They're able to do diagnosis and treatment. Now, there is a point at which they need to make referrals because it's a higher level of care. But for many of the things that are going to occur in the clinic relative to the health needs, the nurse practitioners are very well trained and very capable of taking care of the health needs of the community. They'll plug into us. They'll plug into the adult systems in town. So as patients absolutely need to go to that higher level of care, they're going to have the referral patterns and things. But it really is a neighborhood-based clinic that really does allow it. And this is a model of the future. Nurse practitioners, and I'm so glad that we have such a great training program at Marquette because, you know, we have about 150 nurse practitioners at Children's because we really know that in many cases they do a very capable job and they're supervised by physicians so that there is that oversight. But a lot of the care that they deliver is through protocols and through best practices and care pathways, and it just works.
That's right. No, that's right, Peggy. I think the important thing that Peggy mentioned is this is really based on data. We have great evidence nationwide about how nurse practitioners can really do a very good job. And we know not only from what we've done at Marquette and what we see our nurse practitioners doing at Children's that nurse practitioners provide exceptional care.
I want to add on to something Margaret said because I think it's really important and why we want to be in neighborhoods. When we look at the data that's published in the literature, health care delivery only determines about 20% of an individual's health status. It's poverty. It's access to good food. It's safety. It's security. It's education. There are about 20 other determinants of health care that we have to take into consideration. So when you're in a neighborhood, you know where there is or isn't fresh food. You know what resources are available to those families for a myriad of things that they're struggling with. And so we've been also developing relationships with Housing and Urban Development, the police department, and others, so that as we understand better what the comprehensive needs are of those individuals, you know, along with the Golan Center and the YMCA, we can then begin to build the competencies those families need to develop themselves in order for them to be successful themselves and also to successfully raise their children.
This seems like a really holistic approach.
It's very holistic. And I think one of the things that our nurse practitioners are so excited about is being at COA Golden and at the Y, because so much of what we would want to do in terms of best practice for our clients, our patients, might be as simple as saying, you know, we have to get you going on an exercise regimen. And that's a really hard thing to say to a patient if they have no hopes of ever getting into a health club or a health facility. The beauty of this relationship, both of these sites have those kinds of resources available. So our nurse practitioners now can not only say, well, we'll take care of the issue that you came to see us with today, a fever. But you know, I've also noticed that, you know, your weight's a little bit up. You told me that you're not really very good at exercising. I want you to go around the corner and go down here and start investigating the programs that COA Golden has or the Y has with regard to exercise and wellness. So having those resources there in the community for us to call on, it's really a very unique model. And we're really excited. We're also excited that we're going to be collecting data on this. We're going to be studying our impact in the community in concert with the staff and the programming of both of these centers. So we are going to be able to demonstrate our effectiveness. And I think that will not only tell us that we're doing a good job right here in inner city Milwaukee, but I firmly believe that this will be a model we'll be able to demonstrate could be moved to other places, not only in Milwaukee, but around the country.
I wonder if this isn't part of a trend where nurse-managed clinics are becoming more popular. And I wonder, was there an impact when the Affordable Care Act went into law? Has that impacted it at all?
No, this is just really, you know, so what's happening across the country, Stephanie, is that, and I talk to employers all the time, nobody wants to pay more for their health care, right? And they really want value-based health care. So I can tell you a lot of this work was in development. And, of course, the Affordable Care Act, because the conversation now is all about health care, right? It probably accelerated it. But this trend has been emerging because the difference is, you know, the health care spend in the United States of America is 18% of the GDP. Back when in the 90s when they started the healthcare, let's look at it and see what we can do, it was 11%. So the enormous growth in the actual spend of healthcare, I think, has really been the driving force. And employers saying, help, you know, we need to get value-based healthcare. So I think it was, to me, an evolution of many different aspects that came together. And I think there's a huge accountability on us in healthcare to make sure that we're looking at the most efficient, effective ways to deliver the best outcomes. And while this isn't the only way and is part of an ecosystem, it's a very important way. And it's something that the community actually embraces. We will continue to work with the neighbors who helped us get to this point because we have three neighborhood groups. We've got one at the Golan Heights. We've got one at the YMCA. And we're also at the Next Door Foundation with a similar model. And, you know, they're going to continue to inform and advise us about what else they need. And back to Margaret's point, I mean, right now, Tom Schneider at Golan Heights, one of the big, big things that the community lacks is access to fresh food. You can't imagine how hard it is to find an apple or a banana. We did a little study, and it costs more to buy an apple or banana in those neighborhoods than it does out in Waukesha County because the access to it. So he's out now trying to source a grocery store, you know, to come and be an anchor store that would then allow people to get fresh foods, and he has cooking classes that teach. So we, like I said, it's an ecosystem of support and services to try to get people towards health.
Are there markers you're trying to accomplish, specific community health goals?
Yeah, and let me tell you, because when our board of trustees 3 or 4 years ago said, you know, we're going to adopt the vision that we want the children of Wisconsin to be the healthiest in the nation, we looked at about 50 different determinants of health outcomes. And we said we've got to pick some that really would indicate that the health of the population is improving. So we're looking at things like immunization rates, infant mortality, asthma admissions to the hospital that are really, again, they're not the only indicators, but they do really give you a little deeper insight into what is really going on with the overall health.
I think the other thing is some of the things that we'll be looking at will be very simple, and we'll start to know it very soon. I talked to our nurse manager just in the last couple of days. They're seeing patients that haven't had a connection to healthcare in years because they couldn't access it. So even just in that little snippet of 2 days, we're already recognizing we're making an impact. And I think that that's only going to be, as Peggy said, one small measure of our overall outcome.
And I wanted to ask about that, Margaret. You had talked before about the importance of making sure this is a sustainable model in the community, because isn't that funding issue part of what's driven out healthcare in these communities, that primary care doctors just really can't afford to stay in these communities where you have high rates of Medicare, Medicaid, and low reimbursement rates?
That's absolutely true. And I think one of the things that we know is current reimbursement for these populations is lower than the actual cost of operating these systems. But the beauty of a nurse-managed center, for example, is that we can do this at a decreased rate, number one. But most importantly here is the fact that Children's Hospital of Wisconsin has set this as a priority, as a goal.
Right now, the way that the health system works, I mean, you're incentivized to make sure that kids get admitted to the hospital and, you know, get lots of care. But at the end of the day, I really truly believe as the healthcare conversation keeps evolving over the next many years, there is going to be incentives for performance around keeping people out of expensive healthcare. And we're already starting to see examples of that across the country. So, you know, it is an investment. It is innovation. But again, you put the stake in the ground, and we said we wanted the health of the children to be the best, not just the health care. You know, we're trying to do our part to change the course and get that care closer to home.
Well, Peggy Troy and Margaret Callahan, thank you both so much for coming in.
Thank you, Stephanie.
Thank you so much.
Peggy Troy is the president and CEO of Children's Hospital and Health System. Margaret Callahan is the dean of the College of Nursing at Marquette University. The organizations have collaborated with Milwaukee's Northside YMCA and the COA Golden Center to open two new nurse-managed community health clinics. Coming up, what do you do if you love Indian food but can't handle gluten? A local author gets us around the gluten conundrum when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Stephanie Lecce. For an increasing number of people in this country, Indian food plays a key role in their diet. But at the same time, the number of people in this country who avoid gluten in their diet is growing as well. It's an issue on the radar of Milwaukee chef and author Alamelu Vibaran. She's written several cookbooks and is host of the local PBS production Healthful Indian Flavors with Alamelu. She's an advocate of healthful eating and Indian cuisine. Her latest book, co-authored by dietitian Margaret Pfeffer, is Indian-inspired gluten-free cooking. Vibaran tells Dan Harmon why she chose to combine Indian influences with gluten-free offerings.
I was doing quite a lot of presentations in the public, in the university outreach program, hospital outreach programs, libraries, farmers market. And whenever I finish cooking the vegetables or rice dishes, people will often come to me and say, Alamelu, is this gluten-free? Is this gluten-free? And there was an enormous interest on gluten-free. And being a healthcare professional myself, I worked with a lot of registered dietitians. So I went and talked to them and they said, yes, the Indian food naturally lends itself to gluten-free, especially South Indian cooking. We don't use wheat that much. Wheat is a staple food in Northern India. Rice is a staple food in Southern India. And another unique thing about South Indian cooking is we use variety of vegetables in everyday meal. And so they said, Alamelu, the vegetable, rice dish, and the lean proteins will lend itself to gluten-free diet. So I decided that's what I want to do. I want to help all these people enjoy good, flavorful food. So let's work on it. That's what I did.
Okay. Well, just paging through the cookbook, it's not hard to notice that it isn't just Indian. I mean, as the title says, it's Indian-inspired.
Yes.
But there's a lot of items in there that you wouldn't typically think would lend themselves well to even Indian-inspired food, like we were talking before about Brussels sprouts.
Right.
And polenta.
Yes. Brussels sprouts, as I, you know, when I was growing up in India, I have tasted Brussels sprouts, broccoli, and all of these things. Those are our unique vegetables that you get it only in the high-end market in India. And I was exposed to those kind of vegetables when I was growing up. So Brussels sprouts, broccoli were all not new to me. And I saw how they prepared the dishes instead of just steaming and boiling and putting some butter. The cooks in my parents' home, how deliciously they prepared these cruciferous vegetables, you know, like cabbage, Brussels sprouts, kale, cauliflower, into a very aromatic, flavorful dish. So I was very familiar with those unusual vegetables. So I thought I will include them in this book. And of course, salmon, quinoa, polenta are all wholesome, healthy foods that we get here. We wanted to broaden the scope. So we thought it would be innovative to add Indian flavor to these good, healthy foods. So we decided to add some spice to make it more appealing and flavorful. That's why we called it Indian inspired.
Okay. Well, and that seems to be a complaint. I mean, I know people who are celiac and are gluten-free. And one complaint is, well, the commercially available products that you get off the shelves are just really bland and boring. So was that something you wanted to get across, is that you don't have to go there?
Exactly. I also, besides working on these cookbooks, you know, I was very fortunate to connect with the professor at MD Anderson Cancer Care Center in Houston, Texas. His name is Dr. Bharat Agarwal, and he has published a book called Healing Spices. And spices have intrinsic health benefits. And I want to inform and educate the public that we can reduce the salt and the fat by enhancing the food with spices, and it adds so much flavor to it, cutting down on salt and heavy cream and all those things. So, yes, spices have intrinsic health benefits. And when you cook all these salmon, quinoa, polenta, vegetables with spices and lentils, you can have anyone love the vegetables and make vegetable haters to vegetable lovers.
Although that's not necessarily the focus of the book, because there are fish.
Yeah,
and
there are
dishes,
fish,
right?
Of course. I do have lean proteins like chicken, fish, shrimp, ground turkey. And lamb is very commonly cooked in non-vegetarian home in India. So I decided to add the lambs too.
Well, were there any difficult moments or difficult or surprises as to trying to make something gluten-free? I mean, are there items that you just were at your wit's end trying to find out how you make something gluten-free?
I have published 4 cookbooks before this. And on all those cookbooks, I have taken the ready-made spice mixes that's available in the Indian grocery store, and I have prepared all the dishes, like sambar powder, it's called rasam powder, chutney powder. Those are all mixes of specific spices that is roasted and ground and packaged, and it's readily available. That's what I was using. But when I started working on the gluten-free cookbook, my co-author, Margaret Pfeiffer, who's a registered dietitian, she went through those packages very carefully, and she said, Alamelu, we can't use any of these products because it has some wheat in it. And she looked at it and she said, these are all we can't use. So I said, okay, I'm going to think about how I can make authentic dishes with locally available ingredients. So I went to the mainstream grocery store, Dan, and just bought the cayenne, ground cumin. And of course, now the main grocery stores have a big spice aisle, so it's no difficulty finding those. But I brought them home, and instead of using those ground mix that was available from India, I started using these spices, making the authentic dishes. I was kind of nervous to see how it's going to turn out, but believe it or not, it was very good. My husband said, this is really neat. You can get it from the locally available ingredients and make authentic dishes. So that was a challenge for me, to let go of those spice powders that I used to and then go experiment myself with the new spices and try to make the authentic dishes. Otherwise, it wasn't that difficult. And having Margaret with me was wonderful putting this cookbook together.
And I know people who attempt Indian cuisine at home. It seems like the biggest fear I hear people mention is spices. They're afraid of the spices.
Right.
This one looks pretty straightforward.
Right. Yeah. And that's what I'm educating the Americans on, you know, in my television and in my presentation. I say spices have intrinsic health benefits. They aid in digestion. There is so many, like turmeric. Okay, turmeric is antioxidant, anti-cancerous, and the research studies shows that the use of turmeric on a daily basis also reduces the risk of Alzheimer's disease. And so in my presentation, it's not just cooking. I do a very good lecture presentation on spices and orient the public about the individual spices and their health benefits. And then I do the cooking program. And spices are not hot by themselves. The hotness really comes from green chilies and peppers. So if you reduce the green chilies and red peppers, the spices are really enhancement. They really enhances the flavor of the dish instead of bland and boring. You cook with the spices and you will see the kids coming running to the kitchen saying, "What are you cooking? Can I taste this?" And I have experienced this so many times in schools.
Do you have a couple of recipes you thought were the most fun?
I remember going to the middle school in Whitefish Bay and also Jewish Day School. They asked me to come for a cooking presentation, and I did vegetable rice pilaf. It has lima beans, green bell peppers, onions, tomatoes, and I have cashews and red onions, and decided to make this dish for the children when they tasted this dish and also another dish called green beans with lentils and coconut, otherwise known as Green Bay Packers Puriel because of the color.
Yeah,
green and
here,
yellow.
Yeah.
The kids, they were so interested in wanting to come and cut the vegetables with me, cook with me, and taste it. And when they are done tasting it, these are all 11-year-olds coming to me and asking me, "Alamelu, where can we get your book? And when I have a birthday, can you come and do a cooking class for us at my home? And can you come and change the cafeteria food?" So the kids were really excited. So I could cook this for anyone, including children. And I know for sure they would love it.
Well, Alamelu Vairavan, thank you for coming on Lake Effect.
Thank you very much, Dan. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Milwaukee chef Alamelu Vairavan is the co-author of Indian-Inspired Gluten-Free Cooking, written with registered dietitian Margaret Pfeffer. She's also host of the public television series Healthful Indian Flavors with Alamelu, and she talked with Dan Harmon. One last break, and then a travel writer helps humble Milwaukee show off what it has to offer. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Stephanie Lecce. For those of you who think you know Milwaukee pretty well, our next guest would like to challenge that notion. Shorewood travel writer Tom Pilarczyk has created a new guide to the city featuring dozens of new ways to explore the city he says is undergoing a 21st century renaissance. Pilarczyk's Milwaukee at Water's Edge offers tips to creating your own urban travel mysteries by visiting little-known city locales. Pilarczyk tells Lake Effect's Nathan Royster why he focused on the area he calls Cosmo Corner.
What I wanted to do is to really focus in on the part of the city that has really a preponderance of attractions and venues that really stress art history, culture, entertainment. And so to focus on that, which is a very unique part of the city, it's a sliver of 5 miles by 1 or 2 miles. I call it the Cosmo Corner because it's much like cosmopolitan cities, but it's really narrowly concentrated in Milwaukee. And so I focus on those city sections along the water from the Milwaukee River down to its mouth, down the lake shore. And so basically from UWM campus and River West, south all the way to the Fifth Ward.
When writing this, did you have a certain demographic in mind or residents or people who haven't been here before, like possible tourists?
Yeah, the answer is yes. It really has resources for tourists, for business travelers who come to the city, for newcomers such as students who move to the city for the university and colleges, for those who, in fact, are young adults moving to the city for the first time, not knowing a lot about Milwaukee, as well as empty nesters moving from the suburbs to the city. In order to really kind of provide for them a resource where they can go deeper than just what a typical travel resource might give them. On the other hand, also wrote it for long-time residents, those who, in fact, might even think that they take advantage of what's in the city. But providing them with a kind of a new way to experience the city by doing an all-day travel experience.
Before reading this book, I didn't think twice about the names Junotown or Walker's Point, and even any of the history on that. Can you explain just like what in Milwaukee's past makes it unique?
You know, all cities are unique. And Milwaukee certainly is unique in terms of the way in which it was founded, where it was founded, and the contributors to how the city developed in time. And so it's interesting in writing any book and doing research on your topic, how you uncover, you know, very interesting things that you never realized. So, for example, the flamboyant playwright Oscar Wilde visited here in the late 1800s, spent time down on water in Wells, I believe, was up on Brady Street, and makes a commentary about Brady Street. And so those little historical nuggets are what make it interesting not only to write a book, but to read a book about the city. My focus, though, in the book really is those who have really made important contributions to the city, especially over the last 15 or 20 years. And in some cases, one might say in a very small way, but really that's not the case. So, for example, you know, the restaurant group that Mike Idle established here now has a number of restaurants from, you know, Trocadero and No Man World Pub to Cafe Hollander and Cafe Benelux. And he's been very conscious in the fact that he was influenced by his European travels and going to Parisian restaurants and, in fact, what those kinds of restaurants really hold for individuals of that city. And so I was really interested in taking a look at how in many places in Milwaukee, it's really people who have a worldly sensibility that have really contributed to the city in one way or the other, from, you know, the Global Union Festival that takes place in Bayview to the Milwaukee Public Market.
So would you say that Milwaukee is one of the more worldly cities in the U.S., or what kind of niche has it carved out for itself?
Well, that's actually why I wrote the book. No, I don't think that it's one of the more worldly cities. It's certainly not a world city, but it has a corner of the city that, in fact, really does have the kinds of attractions and opportunities for urban explorers to take part in, and that's why I wrote the book.
Well, and you use the word urban explorers a lot in this book, too. What does that mean to you?
It means somebody who is open, curious, has a sense of joie de vivre, and is interested in really scratching below the surface to find things that, in fact, they were unaware of. For me, a true worldly explorer is really a cosmopolitan, really a world citizen, somebody who's willing to explore everything from the arts to the built environment, from politics to spirituality.
When we speak of cities, sometimes we think of how we get around them. And say in Seattle, you might think of bicycles. In New York, you're probably going to think of the subway. How is the best way to explore this part of the city?
Well, the great thing about Cosmo Corner is that it's the most walkable area of the entire city. There's this online site that is entitled Walk Score, and it scores every metropolitan area of the United States, every neighborhood of metropolitan areas. and it gives a score in terms of your ability to walk to shops and restaurants and bars and bookstores and art galleries and other venues, museums. And so what's really interesting is that Milwaukee, we're the 30th largest city. We're the 15th most walkable city. Well, that's, I suppose, pretty good. But the area that I wrote about has a walkability score that is higher than the most walkable city in the United States, which is New York City, which is also, of course, one of the most cosmopolitan. So I think that one of the advantages of the Cosmo Corner is that it's really walkable if somebody's up to it, right? 5 miles by 1 or 2 miles isn't a lot of space to cover. If it was a square mile, it'd be 4 square miles. So getting around really is an issue of hitting the leather to the ground or biking, as you mentioned. There's bicycle rickshaws. There's, of course, the public transit system. There are taxis, having one's own car, and so on.
Have you done the bicycle rickshaw? I keep seeing them around.
I think it's a great experience.
Tempted.
Yeah. It, for me, really represents what is unique about River West is one of the city sections I talk about, which is that it is so, I would say, its residents, if you can generalize, are extremely creative, not only in the arts, but as entrepreneurs. And so you find that many of those who spread out around the city as successful entrepreneurs had their beginnings in River West. And the bicycle rickshaw business is just one of them.
Well, what is your favorite experience? Is there something you keep coming back to because it's so so uniquely us or that you'd miss on vacation?
Maybe? Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the things, and I think the State Tourism Agency would say this, as well as a lot of us who enjoy Milwaukee, but the lakefront is really the crown jewel of, I think, Milwaukee. It's what draws people, draws not only residents, but, of course, people from the Midwest and from the nation, just from the specific venues that we have to offer here, especially in the summertime, especially, I guess, from, I would say, May to October. If there's something that I could bottle and take with me wherever I go, it would certainly be the lakefront from all the way from Kenwood Avenue all the way down to the Fifth Ward.
Well, Tom Pilarczyk, thank you for being on the show today.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Milwaukee native Tom Pilarczyk is the author of the new book, Milwaukee at Water's Edge, Resource Guide to the Lively Side. He'll be speaking at Boswell Book Company tomorrow night. You can find more information at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. He spoke with Nathan Royster. I'm Stephanie Lecce. Thanks so much for listening today, and I hope you can catch us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.